welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting shows from radio's yesteryear. I'm your host, Mark Levenier, for an hour of radio drama. Coming up later, movie actor Paul Muni is in the Gulf Screen Guild Theater. But right now, it's The City, a short-lived CBS radio show from June 28, 1947, which profiles an airport in An Impression for Radio. With Earl Lee, Rita Lynn, and Herb Butterfield, Frank Goss is our narrator, and Norman McDonald, producer-director. It's The City.
When you view it from afar, the city is silent, a cluster of towering spires against the sky. But as you move down, across rooftops, over rivers, past factories and rail yards into the center, the city comes alive, jostling, turbulent, bellowing in a thousand voices.
Taxi! Taxi!
Mark it down, $10.
My friends of this great city!
Find the lady flowers! Find the lady flowers!
Signals, crosswalks, the Sherry Carlton Towers, the glass and concrete canyons, rooms with bath or showers.
Hurry, hurry, do I hear 550?
The Philharmonic Concert. The Blue Place. Me too.
The traffic cops, the billboards, the milkman out at dawn. The lights along the freeway coming on and on and on.
CBS presents The City, An Impression for Radio, a cross-section of the thousands of stories of daily living that make the city. And now, with Frank Goss as your narrator, here is tonight's tale of the city, a story called Airport.
The city is a place of arrivals and departures. On the outside, fixed and permanent. But beneath the flat roofs and tall towers changing hourly, a flexible sum with continuous additions and subtractions. Minus 230. The sleek streamliner leaving the train sheds in the shimmering light of afternoon. Diners filled to overflowing in a bridge game already begun in the club car subtracts a fraction from the city. Plus five. A hopeful jalopy turns into the deep, bright thoroughfares of the city. The dust of the Middle West still thick on the mudguard. A mattress strapped from beneath the precarious cover of a propped-up turtleback, three wide-eyed children are added to the sum total that is the city. Plus 423. The great liner, newly repainted with patriotic smokestacks, docks in a tugboat cluster. Proud conveyance in a proud harbor. Smiling at the customs officials, flirting and whistling. Minus one.
Hey, mister, how about a ride? Going north? Hey.
The raised thumb loses its jaunty expectancy as the long yellow shafts of light disappear down the highway, swallowed by the hungry night. By wheels and gasoline, by the gangplank to A-deck and the hobo road, by lumbering buses, broad-chested trains, and soaring wings, the sum of the city has changed, retotaled hourly, with the final tabulation always in doubt. The city is a place of arrivals and departure.
The Constellation from Buenos Aires, Lima, Panama City, Mexico City, and El Paso, arriving at gate 3. Passengers may now board the nonstop flight to New York, leaving from gate 6.
At the city airport, the arrivals are a matter of timetables, bulletin boards, and weather reports. But in an uncomfortable furnished room hung above a busy intersection, they are cause for uneasy concern.
Well, goodbye, Les. I gotta be shoving off. And you'd better to make tracks out to the airport. You don't want to be late. Not tonight.
No, I got plenty of time. She's not due till 11.
You know, when I knew you in college, you're the last guy in the world I'd have picked to marry a French gal. But, heck, the war makes a lot of difference. If I hadn't been in the South Pacific, I'd probably have done the same thing.
Maybe.
I sure don't blame you. I've heard a lot about France.
No.
When we were in the islands, we really envied you guys. A small cafe, mademoiselle. How rendezvous.
Oh, shut up, Cliff.
What? Hey, what's the matter? I'm just kidding.
Well, I don't think it's very funny.
Look, Les, take it easy. I don't blame you for being nervous. I would be, too, if I were in your boots. with a wife I hadn't seen for 2 years and a kid I'd never laid eyes on flying in tonight. But it'll work out. Things always do. Well, so long, fella. Take it easy.
The freckled young man runs his fingers through his stiff, crew-cut hair, slumps against the mohair davenport, thinking, remembering. After a moment, he stands up suddenly and stuffs his hands in the pockets of his faded field jacket. As he moves toward the door, the uncertain light from the dusty chandelier cuts across his sleeve, revealing a dark olive stain where staff sergeant stripes once indicated their authority. Along the banks of the river that partitions the city, the air is filled with the acrid smell that factories belch after meals of coal and oil. This is the domain of the assembly line, the Bessemer converter, the graph, the ledger, and the sales curve. Here, human beings are balanced with the books.
Come in.
Mr. Ryder.
Yes, Beckman, sit down. What's the trouble? Company run out of red ink again?
No, sir.
What is it, then?
Mr. Ryder, I've been the head bookkeeper for Ryder and Lewis for 20 years.
You're 22, Beckman, 22.
Yes, sir. Well, I...
Look, Beckman, no one knows you deserve a raise more than I do, but business conditions haven't been so promising lately, and, well, frankly, we just can't afford it.
Oh, no, sir. It isn't a raise.
Well, it can be very serious.
I'm afraid it is rather serious. You see, Mr. Ryder, I've robbed you of $10,000.
What?
That's right. I've stolen $10,000 from the company's funds. To be exact, just a moment, I have the figures right here. It's $10,346. Yes, that's the total to date.
Oh, I just don't believe it.
Well, I hadn't realized myself that the sum was quite so large. I checked the amount when I was readying the books for the auditor this afternoon. The stock market hasn't been so good this year, Mr. Ryder. In fact, not good at all.
Do I understand you correctly, Beckman? You've been playing the stock market with company funds?
Oh, yes, sir. I've been doing it for years. Only usually I've broken about even. In fact, 1 year I made a considerable profit. I split it with the company, Mr. Ryder. Really, I did. Share and share alike.
Beckman, I just don't know.
I wouldn't have bothered about it, sir, but you see, the sum is so sizable, and with the auditor coming tomorrow, it wouldn't look well for my bookkeeping. All that money unaccounted for, so perhaps you'll want to call the police.
Do you realize that this is a serious matter, that if I call in the police, you're likely to go to the penitentiary?
Oh, yes, Mr. Wright. I'm quite aware of that. And that's why I thought that in view of my 20 years with the company...
22.
22, that perhaps you'd be able to give me a little time. I'm sure I can replace the funds. I've already wired my brother in Denver. He's quite well-to-do, and I'm positive he'll advance me the sum, but I'll have to have a little time. Perhaps you could just explain to the auditor that you'd lent me the money.
Beckman, I don't want to send you to prison any more than you want to go there, but that money isn't mine to lend or give away. It belongs to our stockholders. If I lied about this matter, I'd be as guilty as you are. Can't you understand that?
Yes, sir, I guess you're right. Well, thanks anyway, Mr. Ryder. Thanks very much.
Wait a minute, Beckman. You said your brother would give you the money. How do you know that?
Oh, I have a wire from him, you see.
Oh.
Here it is. You read it, Mr. Ryder.
Tempting, raise money, Denver. Possible, will arrive, flight 17:11 p.m. tonight. Meet at airport. Can't promise, but we'll try. Love, Fred.
I'm sure he'll be able to raise the money, sir. Fred's very influential in Denver. Very influential.
Well, Beckman, in view of your long service, I suppose I could let you have till midnight to replace the money.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Ryder. I can't
That'll
tell you
give
how...
you an hour to get in from the airport. But remember, midnight, or I shall be forced to call the police.
Well, that's all for tonight, Miss Thompson. I have to hurry to the airport. I don't want to miss Meyerbird. Oh, what flight did his wire say?
17 at 11 p.m. I checked it. It's expected on time.
Good girl. I wonder if the old boy's changed much.
You studied under Dr. Meyerbird, didn't you, Professor?
Worshipped at his feet would be closer to the truth. His books were my Bible. Meyerbird's the authority in the field.
Oh?
And now he's going to teach here at the university. He'll be under me. Yeah, there's irony for you.
He's never been to America before, has he?
No, never.
I wonder why.
Well, the fact is, he was coming once, just after the war began. But there was a woman, an American, who lived abroad.
Uh-oh.
They'd known each other for years. She was desperately pulling strings to get back to the States, and her clearance came through before Meyerbird's.
I see.
I don't know exactly what happened after that. She took his passage or talked him out of it. Mm-hmm. Anyway, she got back, and he was left in Europe.
Oh, how terribly unfair.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he could have been so useful to this country.
Yes, I know.
The woman?
Oh, I haven't any idea. I suppose she's around somewhere.
I wonder if they'll meet someday.
I hope not. I sincerely hope not. She nearly ruined his life once. I wouldn't like to think that she'd get another chance.
Darling, it was so wonderful of you to call. I can't tell you how much it means to me.
Well, I couldn't let you get away without a word. What time does your plane leave?
Midnight. Isn't that a ghastly hour to start off?
It's
the only thing I could get, and I have to catch the Queen Mary day after tomorrow. Heaven knows when there'll be another boat.
Oh, my dear, how I envy you. I'd give anything in the world to be going along.
Oh, darling, I just have to get back to Paris. America was all right during the war, but now that the frightful mess is finished, I can't tell you how glad I am to get away. Of course, I was born here, but Paris is my true home, the only place for a cultured person to live.
And, Kurt, you'll be seeing him again, won't you?
Well, I really have no idea. I believe he's married or something, some foreign girl. Anyway, that's all past and forgotten. No, I don't expect to see Kurt.
Flight from Honolulu now unloading at gate 4. Passengers will claim their baggage at the...
The arriving rush up the fenced walk and into the vaulted milling room. Their faces are eager and intent. They carry briefcases, pocketbooks, and unread magazines. They clasp loved ones, hail taxis, and check reservations, all in a frenzied race against time.
All aboard, please.
The departing sling hand baggage and the counter scales, down last-minute cups of coffee, speak adoring, tender words, running their hands through soft, soon-to-be-forgotten hair, buy magazines that will remain unread, or obtain a last-minute teddy bear, a promise nearly neglected amid the convention excitement. Only the waiting moves slowly, dawdling over flat cocktails in the airport restaurant, carefully studying the sudden jerk of the minute hand on the official clock, or wandering aimlessly along the ticket counter, asking foolish, repetitious questions.
Miss. Miss.
Yes, sir?
You're sure the only Flight 17 is the one that comes in at 11 o'clock?
Yes, sir, I'm sure.
Oh, well, thank you. You see, my wife and son are coming in on the plane, and I haven't seen them for a long time. Well, in fact, I've never seen my son, and I wouldn't want to miss them. You understand.
Of course. They'll be here soon. You're meeting the right plane. There's nothing to worry about.
No, not a thing to worry about. Except that I don't know if I want to meet the plane or not. I don't know if there's any hope for a marriage that hasn't really begun. I don't even know if I want Yvonne anymore. If I can learn to love a kid I've never seen. No, I haven't got a thing to worry about. Not a thing.
The young man pulls the faded field jacket tight across his broad chest. He seats himself on a hard bench. His close-cropped head falls back wearily, almost touching the thin gray hair of the man behind him.
Sorry, I didn't mean to bump you.
What? Oh, that's all right. Quite all right.
A pair of pale blue eyes behind steel-rimmed spectacles flash toward the ex-sergeant and then flick upward at the clock as the hands touch 11.
It's time now. Just a few minutes and the whole mess will be over. Fred will bring the money. He's never let me down before. I'll take it to Mr. Ryder. He won't file charges. Give me another chance. But what if Fred doesn't come? What if he didn't get the money? I can't go to prison. I'm not strong enough. I couldn't face the disgrace. No, I'd have to take another way out. Shorter way. If I had the nerve to use a gun.
Attention, please. Flight 17 has been unavoidably delayed. Flight 17 from New York, Cleveland, Chicago, Kansas City, and Denver will not arrive on schedule.
The little man with the steel-rimmed glasses walks quickly over to the counter with nervous steps.
Miss. Oh, miss.
Yes, sir?
That plane. The one that's late. Could you tell me if there was a Mr. Beckman arriving on it? A Mr. Fred Beckman.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir. We don't have passenger lists available for incoming flights.
Oh, I see. Well, how late will it be?
Flight 17? We aren't quite sure. There was illness aboard, and they had to make a special stop in Wichita. I imagine it'll be in about 12:30.
12:30?
Well, perhaps a little sooner, but certainly not until after midnight.
After midnight? Then there's no point in my waiting. Thank you.
The little man stands still for a moment, stunned, his glasses askew, his head drooping on his frail shoulders, his teeth biting into his lower lip. Slowly, walking as in a nightmare, he moves onto the field, creeps past the bright-lit hangars, where tired mechanics feed oil and extra bolts to the hungry fledglings, soon to try their fabric wings. The backwash from a propeller blows the man's glasses onto the ground. He stoops to pick them up and then chuckles.
Silly. I don't imagine I'll need these. I don't expect to do any bookkeeping.
He stops, listening to the night around him. Then he makes a decision. He walks briskly to the public telephone booth, standing like a mute sentinel at the gateway to the field. In the terminal building, the activities of the night continue unaltered. At a writing table in the corner, two white-turbaned Hindus play a serious game of chess. A well-dressed girl lies stretched out on one of the benches, her head cushioned on a folded mink coat. She has fallen asleep and snores with a quiet, polite regularity. The stoop-shouldered professor is immersed in a volume of Earl Stanley Gardner and does not look up as a red-haired woman flounces past him, waving an angry cigarette holder.
Young woman, am I to understand that your company refuses to carry my luggage?
I'm very sorry, madam. The rules allow only 40 pounds to each passenger. We cannot transport wardrobe trunks aboard an airline.
Oh, I must insist on having my trunks with me. They contain cosmetics and tinned food, things I'll need in Paris.
Oh, I'm very sorry. You'll have to ship them by express. We simply don't have the baggage space aboard your plane.
Oh, I never heard of such cheek. I'll report this matter to the head of the airline, personally. Such impudent employees would never be tolerated in Europe. Never. It's one of the troubles with America. Atrocious service.
I'm very sorry, madam.
The minute hand of the official clock moves jerkily onward and in a single motion creates a new yesterday and a new tomorrow. The young man with a crew haircut fingers the lapel of his field jacket and in the bright electric light, shadows grow visibly under his weary eyes.
It's after midnight. The plane should be in now. In one instant, I'll become a husband and a father. But I don't want that. I want to go on like I was, alone. I don't want Yvonne and my son. I don't want to meet the plane.
Flight 17 from New York, Cleveland, Chicago, Kansas City, and Denver is now arriving at gate 5. Flight 17 is now arriving.
Well, they're here. And now I've got a family.
The ex-staff sergeant pulls himself to attention and strides toward gate 5. Flight 17 lies poised at the gateway to the city, serene, silver, and beautiful, her four great engines coughing just a little behind their fans as they slowly relax their violent embrace on the night air. Harried, white-coated attendants push the landing ladder into place, the oval door swings back, and the process of adding to the city is completed as the smiling stewardess assists the passengers downward to their separate city destinies. The couple seem out of place amid the hurrying travelers. Elderly, ill-dressed, gawking with amazement at the distant towers of the city, like wide-eyed children loose in a department store during Christmas time.
Well, Martha, it's been a long trip.
It has been a wonderful trip, Kurt. There is so much of the world to see.
Are you frightened, Martha?
Of course.
So am I, little. Such a big country. With such big cities and big people.
Now, Kurt, you are as big a man as any of them. Bigger.
Not bigger, but perhaps here in America, just as big.
The red-haired woman, Paris-bound, with her cigarette holder tracing gray, gesturing spirals against the searchlit night, hesitates, frowns, and then moves forward eagerly.
Oh, how wonderful. wonderful to see you. When did you get to America? Why didn't you wire? We must go somewhere and talk.
But, hurry,
darling. I only have a few minutes. Unless I put off my trip, I suppose I could.
I'm very sorry, madam.
What?
I'm afraid you've mistaken me for someone else, a different person.
But I don't understand.
I think you must have the wrong man.
Oh, I see. Of course. Sorry to have bothered you. I'm very sorry. That's the trouble with this country. Too many foreigners. It's even more unbearable than ever.
Who was she, Count? Do you know her?
No, my dear. I don't know her.
Dr. Marbert. Do you remember me?
Of course. You're Maxwell, Vienna, 1935.
1936.
Really? I thought it was 35. Oh, this is my wife, Professor Maxwell.
How do you do?
I want to welcome you both to the university. Our city is proud to have you here. America is proud to have you.
The ex-sergeant watches grimly as the passengers walk through gate 5.
Pardon me, are you Mr. Johnson, Yvonne's husband?
Well, yes, I've been waiting for her, but I didn't see her get off the plane.
No, I was a stewardess on Flight 17. Your son was taken ill, and we put down in Wichita so he could have medical attention. That's why the plane was delayed.
The boy's sick?
Now, please don't be alarmed. It's nothing serious. They'll be along in a day or two. Now, don't you worry. Good night.
Good night. And thanks.
The young man hesitates, frowning uncertainly. His eyes are puzzled. He walks a few steps toward the main entrance. Then he turns and paces deliberately to the ticket counter.
Yes?
Could you tell me when I can get a plane for Wichita? I'd like to get there as soon as possible.
Will Mr. Beckman please call at the ticket counter? There's a telegram for him. Mr. Beckman, please.
The voice on the loudspeaker is too weak and too distant to be heard by the little man standing in the telephone booth. His hand shakes violently as he dials a number. His forehead is damp with perspiration. He waits, trembling, trying to mouth the words he will say.
Police station. Sergeant Bundy speaking. Bundy speaking.
Sergeant Bundy. My name is George Beckman. George W. Beckman.
Yeah.
I'm an accountant for Ryder and Lewis. I've stolen some money from my employer. I wish to give myself up.
What?
I'm telephoning you from the airport. You can arrest me here. I'll be waiting for you in the telephone booth near the runway.
Well, I'll be... Okay. You just wait there. I'll have a guy out there pick you up.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mr. Beckman, telegram for Mr. Beckman at the ticket counter, please.
Well, there's no point in calling that any longer, Jim. The guy just isn't around.
It doesn't seem like it.
It's a money order, too. Oh, well, he can get it tomorrow. It'll do him just as much good then as it will now.
CBS has brought you The City, an impression for radio, a cross-section of the thousands of stories and dramas that are enacted daily in the city.
The City, a CBS radio broadcast from June 28, 1947. It's an hour of drama on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. We now turn to the Gulf Screen Guild Theater for a March 5th, 1939 broadcast of the story Bridge of Mercy, a radio play designed to explore the topic of euthanasia and one of the more unique ones heard during radio's golden era. With Louis L. Burney, Lionel Atwill, Harry Bradley, Wheaton Chambers, and star movie actor Paul Muni.
Welcome, everybody. Tonight, your neighborhood Good Gulf dealer joins the Gulf Oil Companies in presenting this new series of programs. Reviews, musical comedies, and dramatic shows. all the varied entertainment forms of Hollywood. So welcome all of you to the Motion Picture Star's own program. Welcome to the Gulf Screen Guild Show. With Paul Muni, Josephine Hutchinson, Lionel Atwill, Louis Alberni, Harry Bradley, Wheaton Chambers, Russell Gleason, George Hackathorn, George Irving, John Middlejohn, our musical director, Oscar Bradley, and Hollywood's favorite master of ceremonies, George Murphy.
Ladies and gentlemen, that long list of names you have just heard represents one of the most unusual casts of film players ever to appear in a radio play. It would be virtually impossible to see a picture coming out of Hollywood without at least one of these characters appearing in it. The reason behind this flocking to the colors is the subject matter of the play itself. Radio, as far as we know, has never been the medium for a discussion so controversial a subject. Bridge of Mercy. This play was adapted by Norman Riley Rain from an original story by True Boardman, directed by George Cukor. Due to the delicate nature of the play's subject, I feel that I should say that neither the sponsor of this program nor the persons appearing in it wish to express any personal conviction in the controversy indicated. Among the first voices, you will recognize Lionel Atwill, John Middlejohn, Paul Muni, and Josephine Hutchison. Lights. Music. Curtain.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I know you will judge this case sanely, rationally, and without sentimental bias. The state intends to present only facts, hard, unemotional facts, which will prove beyond any reasonable doubt that on January the 11th of this year, the defendant, John Carstens, did willfully and with cold, planned premeditation take the life of Mary Carstens, his wife. The defense will work upon your pity and your emotions. But you intelligent men and women will not allow your judgment to be
Derwent, how long have you known the defendant, John Carstens?
Oh, 5 or 6 years. We were both bookkeepers in Greenleaf and Sons. We were pals before he got married.
You mean his marriage made a difference? In what way?
Well, I don't know. He got kind of quiet and quit going out nights with the old crowd.
Then his wife caused that change. And Carstens resented it?
I object, Your Honor. That is a leading question.
Objection sustained. The prosecution will rephrase the question.
Mr. Derwent, suppose you tell us, in your own way, something of the change his marriage made in John Carstens.
Well, I remember the first night I went there after John got married, just as I was leaving.
It was nice having you, George. Sorry you have to go so early.
Oh, you know how it is. Thursday night's bowling night.
Oh, John, why didn't you tell me, dear?
Gosh, Thursday night. Never think of that anymore.
The gang misses you, John.
Don't have time for that now.
You see, George, John's doing some special work at home.
Don't you get enough of that in the office?
It's not exactly work, George. It's, it's kind of a hobby. You know, some fellas play golf and some tear cars apart and stick them together again.
Oh, it isn't. And it's much more than that.
Well, it sounds kind of foolish, I guess, but I'm taking a correspondence course.
Oh, going highbrow on us, huh, Mary?
Of course not. It's a home course in engineering.
Engineering?
Sure. You know, dams, power projects, bridges, a path to the moon and beyond. Just name your order.
Won't that take a long time, John?
Well, I can wait. Nothing else to do except eat and sleep and work and monkey around with this.
Well, I wish you luck with it. Good night, Mary. Night, John.
Come again soon, won't you?
You bet, Mary. Thanks.
So long, George. Kind of wish you hadn't told him about that course, Mary. He'll never quit kidding me at the office.
Oh, darling, I wish you weren't so self-conscious about things you feel. There's nothing wrong about ambition. That's what makes great men different from other men.
Great men? One bookkeeper telling another bookkeeper he's studying to build bridges.
And you will, too, someday.
Build a bridge? Yes, Mary. I will. Someday. I'll build a bridge. A big bridge. A shortcut for people who work hard through the day and for tired people. For people who want to do things and get places.
You will. You will. I know it.
And darling, that day, the first one to walk across will be you.
Quiet, please. Quiet.
Dr. Morton, you were Mary Carson's physician, were you not?
I was.
What has been the state of Mrs. Carson's health for the past 2 years?
Very bad. Summer before last, she developed a form of malignant growth known as sarcoma. I operated, but the condition was already too far gone to be checked. In time, it was certain to reach her heart and cause death.
The deceased suffered pain?
Excruciating. Continuous. The last few months, I've been administering morphine.
When you last saw the deceased alive, was there a possibility of her ultimate recovery?
None whatever. It was only a question of time.
How long a time?
Well, that's impossible to say. It depended entirely upon the progress of the disease and the ability of the patient to withstand pain.
You told her husband, the defendant, this?
I did.
What did he say?
Well, he's rather a reserved
By
man.
By reserved, would you mean indifferent? Calloused?
Your Honor, I object. The prosecution...
Objection sustained. Proceed, Doctor.
Well, as I left his wife's room, he came to meet me.
Any hope?
I'm sorry. There is none.
But surely there must be something you can do. Another operation, a specialist?
I'm afraid there's nothing anyone can do.
But, Doctor, the pain, she can't stand it anymore.
I'm leaving you a prescription for morphine to be given as directed. She has enough by her bedside for today and tonight.
But that doesn't seem to help anymore, Doctor. It did at first, but isn't there anything else?
Unfortunately, no.
We can't do anything more to help her, then.
We can only wait for the end.
The end? How long?
It's hard to tell. A week or a month? She might live indefinitely.
Indefinitely? This pain indefinitely. Tortured indefinitely. Doctor!
I'll stop by in a day or two. Sooner if you need me. Goodbye, Mr. Carsons. I'm very sorry.
Goodbye, Doctor.
Has the doctor gone?
Yes. He's gone.
What did he say?
Well, he said that in a little while now, the worst would be over and that...
I know. That I'd have no more pain.
Yes. Yes, that's right. Mary. Mary, this bottle is empty. What did you do with the morphine? Mary!
I do. Your residence and occupation? St. Anne's Hospital. Ambulance surgeon.
Take the stand, please.
Dr. Baker, you made an emergency call at the Carson's residence on the afternoon of January the 9th.
I did.
What did you find on your arrival?
Mrs. Carson's was in a coma from an overdose of morphine.
An attempt at suicide?
That's what I reported.
I see, I see. Was Mr. Carson's at the house when you arrived?
Yes, sir.
What was his condition? I mean, did he seem worried?
Well, I couldn't say. You see, I had my patient to attend to.
And when you revived Mrs. Carson's, did he seem grateful?
Why, yes, I suppose. That is... Well, I don't remember.
When you left, was the defendant still there?
Yes, in his wife's room.
Who else was in that room when you left?
No one but Mr. Carson's. I went into the next room to make out my report. When I left the house, Mr. and Mrs. Carson's were there.
Are you?
Right here, Mary.
Take my hand. Hold it. Tight. Oh, darling. Why did you let them bring me back?
I was a coward.
I'm such a burden.
A burden?
It's true. But when you're with me, I don't feel so frightened. With only this... Oh... Pain. John.
What, Mary?
What did Dr. Morton say? How long, I mean?
Now, don't worry about that, dear. Just think about getting well again.
John, how long? I've got to know.
A week? A month? Even...
As long as that. John, you said someday when you built your bridge, I'd be the first to cross. Remember?
Yes. I remember.
I need that bridge. Now, will you build it for me?
Build you it? Mary, you don't mean...
I'd go across so gladly.
Well, you don't know what you're asking of me.
I do know. Please, dear. I'll wait for you, just on the other side.
You're talking nonsense, darling. Why, doctors aren't infallible. Lift up your head. Look at me. Now smile. Not a very wide one. Why, you'll live to dance a jig at my wake. And Dr. Morton's, too. Why, you've got years ahead of you.
Morphine. If you gave me more, just half a grain more. It's so quick and so easy, just like falling asleep. It isn't wrong. It can't be. John, please don't make me wait too long.
Mary, forget all this crazy, morbid thing. Why, this...
Oh.
Yes. You're right. It can't wait too long.
Your name is Alice Smith?
Yes, sir.
You're employed by Greenleaf and Son, where John Carson's worked as a bookkeeper?
Yes, sir.
On the afternoon of January the 11th, you and Carson's were working on the accounts?
Yes, sir, until 3 o'clock.
Then what happened?
Well, you see, we were working together, and he seemed worried and upset. I was calling the figures, and he was punching them on the... Eighteen. 46.
46.
Build a bridge.
97.
97. For me to cross. 17.
17.
Build a bridge.
32. 30 bridge.
I said 32.
32.
A week or a month, indefinitely.
This torture. I can't bear it, John.
28. Bridge 8.
I call 28.
28.
No hope.
Morphine. 33.
Grange 3.
I call 33.
Grange 3.
Not too long, John. Not too long.
51.
51. Morphine.
88. Bridge.
Build a bridge. Build a bridge.
Mr. Carson. Mr. Carson, what's the matter? Don't you feel well? Can I get... Where are you going?
Going? I'm going to build a bridge.
Antonio Romano, take the stand, please.
Say.
Your address and occupation?
Atlanta Street, 402. I am a barber.
Thank you.
It is no trouble, thank you. Mr. Romano, your place is directly across the street from Kane's drugstore, I believe. Sure. Were you in your shop on the afternoon of January the 11th? Sure. What were you doing at approximately 3:30? Excuse, please, mister. I don't get that approx. At about 3:30, then. What were you doing? I sit in the barber chair. It is a nice and comfortable. No doubt. And as you were there, did you see Mr. Carson's defendant come down the steps from the elevated and walk towards Kane's drugstore? Sure, I saw him. Did he go directly into the store? No, he walked by it 2 or 3 times. As though trying to make up his mind about something. How I know how he walks? No, you wouldn't. But eventually, he did go into the drugstore. Sure, he walked by 2 or 3 times, and then he go inside, just like him.
Oh, hello there, Mr. Carson.
Hello, Kane. Let me have a pack of cigarettes, will you?
You bet. There you are. Say, you feeling all right? You look kind of...
I'm all right. I feel fine. Look, I'd better have some toothpaste, and I'd like you to fill this prescription of Dr. Morton's.
Sure thing. Morphine, eh? Your wife no better?
No better.
Say, this is kind of a large amount, isn't it? Dr. Morton don't usually prescribe...
Well, Dr. Morton's going away for a day or so, and she needs it in increasing doses. You see, it says to be taken as ordered.
Sure, sure. I just wanted to be sure the doctor hadn't made a mistake. We can't be too careful, you know.
What about you? You'll be alone.
Me? I'll be all right, I guess.
You won't do anything foolish? Try to follow?
No, I won't do anything foolish.
You must promise.
I promise.
Now. Kiss me, John.
You're not frightened, darling.
No. John. What's it like out there? Will it be cold?
No, dear. It's warm. And peace. No more pain. Just sleep. Sleep.
I want to hear your voice follow me all the way across. Such a long bridge, dearest. So long. The mist. It's rising. It's cold. John. 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 Where are you?
Here, Mary. Holding your hand. Don't be afraid. That's it. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid.
Mary Parsons might have lived for some time still. The defense claims she wished, against all human instinct, to die. But we have proven that the defendant did lie to the druggist about Mr. Dr. Morton having left the city and did forge a deadly prescription, raising the amount of morphine prescribed by said Dr. Morton. Ladies and gentlemen, this man murdered his sick and helpless wife by administering to her a lethal dose of morphine.
Gentlemen of the jury, consider these truths. Mary Carsons was so hopelessly ill, so racked with insufferable pain, that she even attempted suicide. And if I say, John Carsons, this loyal and compassionate husband, did help this poor tortured soul to that long sleep she so desperately desired, then it is not you, but a higher.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, have you reached a verdict?
We have, Your Honor.
Carsons.
Hand it to the clerk of the court, please.
Carsons, you're a free man. I can tell by their faces.
We, the jury, find the defendant, John Carsons, not...
No! No, you can't free me! I'm guilty! I did murder my wife!
Mr. Carsons, do you know what you're saying?
Of course I know what I say. I killed my wife.
John, stop it, you fool. Don't you realize?
Let him talk. Yes, let me talk. Let me tell you what it means to be tied hand and foot week after week, month after month, to a dying woman. Long, dull days in a sickly house, sleepless nights, incessant care of a helpless burden that stands on a threshold of death and refuses to cross. Refuses!
till you eat your soul away hunting for a means to free yourself. Suicide. It wasn't suicide, it was murder. I tried it once and failed because the ambulance got there too soon. The second time, I did not fail. That's the truth, gentlemen. I gave her the morphine, a fatal dose, deliberately. And it killed her. I killed her.
My son.
Yes. I'm ready. Gordon.
Yes, John.
Thanks for everything. You did your best.
You wouldn't let me do my best.
Our Father, who art in heaven.
I can't understand it, John. Why did you throw your life away like that?
Hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come.
At least the world would have thought better of you.
Yes. Is that important?
Thy will be done on earth.
Perhaps even now I could.
No.
As it is in heaven.
But why? Why? You must have had a reason.
Yes. I had a reason. I had to make sure. Very sure.
That you would die?
Give us this day our daily bread.
Already, Warden.
Steady, John. You won't say anything more?
Only goodbye.
And forgive us our trespasses.
Mary, where are you? I can't see you.
Don't be afraid, darling. Don't be afraid.
Mary,
forgive them.
I had to lie about you being a burden. Forgive me. It was something stronger than I.
It was my voice, John. Don't you see, darling? You had to die. To be punished on earth.
And yes. Trespass against us?
Yes. I know now. Others, seeing me go free, might kill through hate and hide behind the cloak of mercy.
And lead us not into temptation.
But why can't I see you now? You said you'd wait for me.
I am waiting, dear. I can go no farther now. Nor you. It's our punishment.
Punishment? Still? How long? How long, Mary?
Perhaps until we've learned that pain and suffering must be borne. As a cross is borne to the appointed place.
But deliver us from evil.
I'll be waiting for you, darling. At the end of the bridge.
For thine is the kingdom.
And the power.
And the glory.
Forever and ever. Amen.
For the Gulf Oil Companies and the members of the Screen Guilds, I want to thank Paul Muni, Josephine Hutchison, Lionel Atwell, Louis Alberni, Harry Bradley, Wheaton Chambers, Russell Gleason, George Hackathorn, George Irving, and John Miljohn for one of the best performances in our series of Screen Guild shows. Muni, I know how much time and hard work you've given to this performance. And we are very, very grateful to you indeed.
Thank you, George. And speaking for myself and the rest of tonight's cast, we'd like to thank the Good Gulf Dealers and the Gulf Oil Companies for presenting us with the opportunity of doing our part for such a worthy cause, the needs of the Motion Picture Relief Fund.
Thank you, Paul Muni, and good night. Next week, ladies and gentlemen, the same time, the same station, the Good Gulf Dealer in your neighborhood joins the Gulf Oil Companies in welcoming you to another Gulf Screen Guild show with Carol Lombard, James Stewart, Spring Byington, and Edward Everett Horton in a comedy drama tailored by Tony, written by Connie Lee, and directed by Dorothy Arzner. Until then, this is George Murphy saying thank you for the motion picture industry and the Gulf Oil Companies, and good night.
Grateful to 20th Century Fox for Lionel Atwill and Russell Gleason, to MGM for George Murphy, and to Warner Brothers for Paul Muni, soon to be seen in Juarez. John Conte speaking. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The Gulf Screen Guild Theater on Tuned To Yesterday, the story Bridge of Mercy, broadcast first on March 5th, 1939 on CBS. And that brings to an end this hour of drama on Tuned To Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's yesteryear. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Livonia. It's been a pleasure.